when we talk about end of oil, Calvin, are we talking about the end of cheap and plentiful oil?
We need to get away from the idea that oil is becoming running out, because we probably used half of the fossil fuel resource that the world has left us, and there's half left there. There's plenty of oil around if we go after it. The real question is what does cheap mean? How do we define cheap oil? So we need to be asking how much oil is available, i.e. it can be pumped in any one year, what's the productive rate that we can get, how long can that productive rate hold up, and what's the price of that? And obviously, over time, as cheaper producers are unable to ramp up any further, the Saudis have just managed to squeeze up with 10 million barrels at the moment. They promised 15 million last year, but they're not anywhere near that. Then obviously we're bringing it on more expensive, and in some cases more environmentally damaging, oil and other fossil fuel supplies such as tar sands and fracked oil and tight oil and so on and so forth. I am going to be a bit economics, I do apologise. I don't know numbers, PowerPoint. We have to remember that our steady period of economic growth that we've seen, particularly post 1750, it's a child of the oil age. Now, Adam Smith wrote his seminal piece, Wealth of Nations, in 1776. Newcomen's steam engine, first emptying coal mines, that was 1723, I think. I think the engineer would probably tell me if I'm wrong. So this era of ever-increasing prosperity year on year, we've gone into the bumps in the road, is wholly a product of very, very cheap energy and largely fossil fuel energy. And we see in 1973, for example, after six days, not Yom Kippur, anybody, historians, 6 days, well, it wasn't 1973. We see when there are bumps in the road, what happens to our economy when we don't have access to that cheap energy. And of course, that was as true of the Romans as it is for us. The Roman economy expanded as long as Romans could bring in more resources, have more surpluses, and they did that through expansion, colonialism, effectively. Unfortunately, we've butted up against the limit of that these days, because there's nowhere left to expand into, leaving aside Antarctica and the Arctic. Everywhere else is already claimed. The only question really you have to ask is, for us, can we produce goods and services at a cost which is lower than the value put upon it by consumers who might buy those goods and services? Because the only game in town for the West is consumption. If people stop consuming, then the whole deck of cards falls down. And of course, the cost of those investments are very largely pinned to the cost of energy. And the cost of energy is very largely pinned to the cost of oil, still. Global oil prices. Different, as you hear, the small differences in the US and Europe when you can't transport the stuff easily. So, consumption is the only game in town. Can we still afford to consume the fruits of, the 50-inch TVs, the tourist attractions, whatever it is, that are put in front of us? Can we afford to consume those as consumers, given the price that we have to pay to create those using energy as a fundamental driver? Our problem at the moment is it's increasingly clear that really we can't. What we see, particularly since 2007, but more generally since 1980, is a narrowing base of affluence. The last 6 years now, we've had real wages, median wages, so the kind of average, not quite average, the average wage, UK, US, and much of Europe has stagnated or fallen back since 2008-9, and we see an increased concentration of wealth. The word of Piketty shows that very clearly. And this is not new, because this is something that a semi-famous economist called Karl Marx predicted a long time ago, in the mid-19th century, that over time, concentration of ownership, concentration of power then with that, concentration of economic weight would narrow the base of the proletariat, would cut the consumption mechanism from under capitalism, because people remaining in the proletariat and having money to consume the goods that were being produced. And in his view, that would lead to the immiseration of the proles and eventual revolution. I haven't quite got there. The problem is that as soon as you get to a position where you cannot find enough consumers for the stuff you're producing with the energy that it becomes more expensive, and hence the products become more expensive, then the whole stack of cards collapses. Once people don't believe that the economy would grow next year, at either a regional, national, or international level, then there is no value in investment. The only reason that the Dutch East India Company succeeded, the only reason we sent the spice ships out to India and China and back, is because we thought that there was profit in it, reliant on an ever-growing economy and ever-growing resource base. Once that narrative and that myth breaks down, and you know, we're not there yet, but we should be thinking about medium and long term here, then there really isn't any reason to do anything other than invest in gold, as we see people already are, and put things of value under your mattress. And once that happens, of course, the rationale to employ people falls down and we enter a kind of spiral. We can't seem to fathom a way, certainly in the UK, to employ enough people in enough meaningful ways to give them enough money to at least indulge in one last splurge, irrespective of what it might do to the climate or the environment. We can't even give people enough money to buy the flat-screen TVs anymore in sufficient number to generate economic growth. So the question, I'll come back to the question at the finish. What level of oil is cheap enough to enable a continuation of this consumption economy, this is the medium term? Is it the $80 we have now, following a very weak prognosis for the global economy and some extra oil coming in? Is it the $100 of oil that we've seen really over the last 2 or 3 years? Or is it the $200 oil that the IMF project by 2020? And I'll leave that question open to the floor.
Well, shall we start getting questions on that? Chris will be here with a microphone now. I mean, we've had discussions about peak oil. There was a lot of talk about peak oil in 2008, 2009. I remember when I started in my job as an environment correspondent. Far less talk about cheap oil now. And maybe there's a reason for that in terms of what's happening with fracking in America. Any questions from what you've heard so far?
Kevin, more basically, but the question seems to be a bit narrow. You're saying what level is cheap oil? But isn't the case of what level is cheap oil in comparison to something else?
Yeah, I mean, I made the point earlier that really, when we think about the price of gas, or the price of fracked gas, type oil, fracked, other resources, tar sands, really, because the price of oil is the global mediator, if fracked, say tar sands come out of the ground and get to market at $90 a barrel, and the price of oil, i.e. the stuff that actually flows when you pull it out, is $80 a barrel, nobody will frack anything or invest in tar sands. So the Saudis, with their production of easy oil, cheap oil, liquid oil, still have that mediating facility as deciding what's investable or not. So the price of oil is a reasonable shorthand thing about the price of fossil fuels, leaving aside the issue said about things you can't transport very easily, such as gas, which do then have regional differences. But I mean, yes, of course, It's fossil fuels as a basket, as you sort of think about
it. Well, what's behind it all is the fact that the US shale oil is coming off stream. So, that, as with the US shale gas, these are significant price movements in the market. Today's papers are all full of. At what point will the US shale oil become uneconomical, given the fact that the Saudi price and whatever the Brent oil price is? And the collective wisdom is that there's still quite a long way down it could go before the US shales can't produce.
And if that translates into cheaper prices at the pump, if we pay less for our petrol and diesel,
we will just. Obviously, the knock-on effect would be obvious, won't it? But as I said, I think all of this should be set in the wider context of climate change and in the wider context of what we will ultimately do if we do that, And all of this needs to be managed carefully in some way, shape, or form. And the transitions as we reach, the context, as I understand it, is what the Peter is doing and what we can do in this country up to 2050 and beyond. That's my personal view is, I'm not in the, don't panic Captain Rainwearing camp, I do not believe we are doomed. I think there are things that we can and should do, and we just need to keep going strongly on that path.
But doesn't the technological advances in terms of the oil and gas industry in the United States now, doesn't it actually open up more oil for those companies in America? They're importing far less from the Middle East than from Saudi.
Well, that revolution, if that's the way you describe it in the US, has had a profound effect on the US economy. It's a completely disruptive technology that has been delivered there.
I mean, how is it right? I mean, the problem is, you know, the time scale that you look upon these things is really important, because the, I'm aware I'm sitting on a panel with a GI engineer, so I'm really careful, but a typical shale gas well will last 5 years. You know, you take most of the oil out in the first 18 months to 2 years, since the production of gas and oil, I think. So you need this constant reinvestment and more rigs to keep production going. So you have a huge glut, and of course what's happening now is many of the companies that invested in shale resources and bought shale resources at a high price of gas, in there, particularly gas, and they're having to sell them on the market, which is hugely, glut of gas, but of course there's a huge gold rush type of thing. So at the moment we're seeing the American economy, which is not, it's not a coincidence the American economy is growing the most strongly of really any economy in the West. At the same time, it's got relatively cheap oil, cheap energy. Well.
I'm in danger now of entering into the world of economists. But the economic reports I read, and there aren't many of them, I don't understand them, do tend to have quite a strong linkage with the US economy. Yeah. And ironically, you know, President Obama's political success linked to all the work that Vice President Cheney did at Halliburton in getting all these
offers. Yeah, I mean, my worry is, you see this, I think the US is a nice microcosm for the rest of us, really, because the shale is a disruptive technology, or the application of fracking in this way is a disruptive technology. And, there will be a period, and we hear this morning, Carol saying 30, 50 years, I mean, on the more pessimistic side, you're talking about a decade or two, when you will have a glut of various fossil fuel energies. And on current trends, I know Magellan Shale was downgraded by 94% 3 months ago by the U.S. Department of Energy and Environment. So, we're not sure how much stuff is there. But on current trends, once it's gone, America will be in exactly the same position it was in 2009-10, before it started doing this conversion, because they won't have changed really any of their underlying social systems, distributed systems, productive systems, using this gold, this plenty of cheap energy in a way to actually become more resilient or change the economy. And what will happen is, in 2025 or 2030, they'll be back in the Middle East.
So short-term policy.
Back in the Middle East, looking for what's left there. Unless they can actually invest that energy in a way which makes them more resilient long-term.
Yes, sir.
Can I just say, first of all, I have absolutely no vested interest in the shale gas industry. But just a few absolutely basic facts. There are vast resources in gas, in predicted emissions. There is a school of thought emerging today that think that there's more gas in the shales than there was in conventional gas. This is not a short-term blip. In the United States, places like Milford Haven, Pembroke Dock, being built for inward supply of gas, have been converted so that it goes the other way. The latest news is of a major, major pipeline that has been built from the Rockies to go down to the Northeast to give gas, produce gas for the Northeast, is being converted to deliver gas in the other direction. There are the probability is there are vast, vast quantities of gas in the UK. It's all still to be determined. But I wouldn't want anybody to think this is just a short-term blip. This is a major, major change. Whether or not it can be brought to the surface, not because of just the technological or geological conditions, but because of public acceptance, and I think in our small country, public acceptance is the big thing, but it is very, very significant. It's not particularly good news for climate change. Other than in the US, the gas has replaced the coal, and so the US is hitting its emissions targets as well. So it is a thoroughly, thoroughly good news story for the US. Whether that can be translated across the Atlantic is a big, big question.
So the dependency on hydrocarbons will increase. I can see a few hands up there, so maybe can we? Yes, the gentleman. Thank you.
My name is Jim Poole. I work for Natural Resources Wales. I've had the fun of working with carbon and carbon. Carbon's quite right in saying actually the last 150 years have been They had a child at the fossil fuel age. But the point is that that fossil fuel hasn't just been used by itself. What it's led to is a lot of collateral damage. The use of that oil and coal has led to a major environmental trashing, the collapse of many ecosystems, and a degradation of ecosystem services. So we face a future where it's not just energy insecurity, there's food insecurity, water insecurity, and there's a limit to which abundant energy can actually solve any of these other insecurities. So you cannot now have a debate just about an energy future. It's got to be a much more broad debate than that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, definitely here.
Thanks. Graham Owen from Energy Saving Trust. I wanted to return to the issue about alternatives. And given that renewable energy is pretty much the first major change in energy generation that's had to happen within a private sector context rather than within the CEGB, and that both the fossil and nuclear industries are still massively dependent on the investment made in infrastructure by the state back then. Can you make any comment about how to create a level playing field kind of in that context for renewables? And also just a wider comment on what you think the trajectory of prices for renewables would be with a massive drop in the solar cost.
Well, I mean, I think you need to differentiate between big renewables, small renewables, or concentrated and diffuse renewables. I'm not sure that an offshore wind farm necessarily faces much of a... I mean, obviously, there's the start of the cost of capital, which you don't have for the grid. You know. I think that those will be, those positions will be worked out, same as the lagoon, with negotiation by a contract of difference, you know, good or bad, whatever happens, depending on lobbying and strength of the negotiating party. I think it's a much more difficult issue when it comes to diffuse renewables, if you like, where you, whenever I go and see renewable installations, usually across Wales or Scotland and other places, I just wonder what the point is of creating these things, spin them up to 240 volts, or more in most cases, send them off somewhere else, and bring them back, you know, but we sit in a grid which is mostly a one-way grid, not fully one-way. Mostly a centralised, you know, send and return type of setup. And I think that the renewal of the grid and the re-engineering of the grid, which I know Cardiff University is actually very heavily involved in, hopefully, going forward, and the understanding of where you really may just not need 240 volts all the time in all places, that sort of conversation hasn't really started as far as I would like it yet. But once that starts, when you think about, you know, it's funny, it's very much an anecdote, but out my back, I've got a little coal hole, because I have a coal in the end book, so I've got burn coal, clearly. although it's only left of my thought while I was there. You know, under that mountain, any day of the year, it sits at about 4 degrees C. You know, it goes down the winter, obviously. So don't need the fridge. You know, once you start thinking about what you actually need as opposed to what you want, then I think renewables, as part of a mix, you know, topping up, maybe 24 volts, not 240, then you could start to have conversations about changing the way we consume in order to enable a more diffuse setup, both ownership-wise and technologically.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. It's partly just about kind of generation costs in terms of technology
improvement. If I could just add one point. It's very much about distribution costs as well. The generation, and just isolating generation, is not dangerous, but it's kind of missing a big part of the picture, because whatever is produced has to supply somewhere. And that was the point about what I said earlier about they were literally paying people to take the electricity away, because it happened to have an occasion where the wind was blowing a lot at night and they didn't know what to do with it.
Any questions in terms of how do we wean ourselves off using hydrocarbons and oil and gas and more new sources of energy in the future.
Terry Cosborne, Colonel Cymru. I want to contrast the presentations we've just had, the ones we had earlier this morning. The ones we've just had seem to be really speaking of the inevitability of the oil and the new gas finds being used and exploited massively over the next few years because of the price and the cost that they'll be coming through at. And there wasn't in these two presentations, the same recognition as we've had in the energy production field, that things have got to change because of climate change. In the energy production field, we are looking towards a steady transition towards renewables. The pace is still to be argued about the exact form of it, but we've got to get there in order to deal with it.
Do you think it's political leadership, or do you think it's market forces?
Well, what I wanted to ask was, what about the transport sector, which is particularly relevant to the oil issue that you were talking about? What are we doing to ensure that the gradual move towards hybrids, towards electric cars, electric vehicles and so on, where the electricity can come from renewables, is maintained even in a period where oil prices and gas prices may be weak, maybe low, for another decade or two?
Well, I mean, the extent to which you have to move towards renewables to electrify our transport system didn't happen when oil was $140. It's not going to happen when oil is $80, you know, or whatever the shale revolution sets the price at. It's to do with some costs, as we heard earlier. You know, it's to do with a non-level playing field. I think it's also to do with the fact that you really can't run an industrial society of the sort we have on renewables. It's ludicrous that I've said this before a number of times, it's a ridiculous thing that we use a 1,500 kilogram box of metal, plastic and rubber to move around an 80 kilogram bag of water. I mean, that's just a stupid thing to do. And any society that wants to subsist on renewables, I'm sure Zero Carbon would and Catherine agree with me, any society that wants to subsist on renewables, not a million years of sunshine, which is what we've been doing with, has to give up some fairly cherished things like easy mobility. Because we simply, lifting a metal box into the air is always going to be incredibly energy intense. And when energy is more scarce, there will always be a better use of that energy, whether it's virgin biofuel or whatever. We always have better things to do with it than move people around to sit on a beach. So once we start to have those sorts of conversations, we can have a conversation about what sort of maybe post-industrial society can subsist on a more diffuse and more difficult energy resource, set of energy resources than fossil fuels.
Can I get a few more questions on that? One here from me.
Just a simple question. Should the Welsh Government encourage fracking in Wales?
Okay, let's get down to a narrow issue. We were talking about whether it's market forces or whether it's political leadership. In terms of fracking, if this resource is there in the future in South Wales and in large swathes of England, is it a political decision by a Welsh government, first of all, to say, yes, we should exploit it?
Well, the politics is to do with the politics of devolution and who has responsibility for the energy policy. There's nothing in it for the Welsh government. Moment other than having to deal with the public furor that would arise if something like that happened. But in the wake of what happened in Scotland, who knows what might or might not emerge. Your bigger question, I suppose, is should the UK use shale gas? But the context is very, very straightforward, isn't it? We have lived in the UK, very nicely, thank you, on North Sea gas for quite a long time. It's been a good ride. My generation, we've done okay out of it. I remember when the conversions took place. It's coming to an end. Over the next 30 years, that resource is going to decline. We have a simple choice to make. Where are we going to get the gas that we're not going to get from the North Sea? As things stood before we discovered that there was shale gas in the UK, it was quite clear what the direction of travel was, and it was despite notwithstanding all the rest with LNG, etc., etc. Now we have an alternative option as a country. Do we want to look at that? You're asking the question about transitions and so on. There's a clear 30-year transition there to 2050. That's, I understand it, that's Westminster government policy. Nobody's talking about not using gas for the next 30 years. It's a question of which gas and where the gas will come from. And the choice for the UK then is, try and go for shale gas? You've got the answer from the current Westminster government. You've got the answer from the minister. 40% of the UK has now been put up for a
potential federal licenses. Is it a case of political leadership of what kind of source of energy we use in future carbon, or does it come down to, for instance, the price of oil and keeps on going down? So if this gas is there, unconventional gas, then it's a no-brainer for any government.
It's large enough after government, is it? I mean, because we have a private-based energy industry, largest industry in the UK, there's not much to say over it. I mean, but my issue
could in terms of planning.
Well, it certainly can in terms of planning. My issue is that what we've heard this morning quite a lot of is gas, particularly being positive and maybe nuclear as a transition towards a renewable future. At the moment, what's happening is that gas is in some cases out competing renewable investments, and we see that with the offshore wind. And the offshore wind just gets kiboshed as soon as possible by them now. So it's a fallacy that there's any strategic move towards a post-decarbonized future. So using shale in Wales and in the UK, as I said, almost just methadone on top of heroin, with no prospect of getting the patient or no plan to get the patient off. Because if we put shale in the same centralized distribution system we've got now, we're just kicking the can down the road. Because we will stop, we won't build a parallel system for a renewable world at the same time as using shale, I suspect, because we've been told that redundancy is bad, redundancy is costly, which is one system, it'll be fine, we make it resilient, and we go one path. And slightly unrelated point, but if I was going to frack Wales, I certainly wouldn't do it at the same time as England and wait until they use all theirs first to the price on it.
question by the lady in the back there. And if there are any other questions, more questions in terms of another tongue-in-cheek comment made by Calvin earlier, that you can't run an economy on renewables. There are questions along those lines. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Fiona from NRW. To echo some of the things that Calvin said, especially on the shale gas, really the IPCC recognizes natural gas as a bridging technology, but that is under the condition that it will displace coal. So when you look at America, yes, it has brought down the price of gas in America, but did they displace the coal? I think they're just quite happily exporting it somewhere, which does not actually have on the climate agenda. So this is something that we have to think about in the UK in terms of how we push the shale gas agenda.
Who do you want to answer that? Do you want somebody to reply to that? Okay, we'll take another question.
So this is in relation to running an economy on renewables, I guess. I'm going to say what I said earlier, it depends what kind of economy you want to run.
That's what I said.
And I agree with you, but I'm just going to challenge a couple of points. First of all, the term, ever-increasing prosperity based on access to cheap oil. I think, what do we mean by ever-increasing prosperity? If we're looking at GDP, if we're looking at growth, then yeah, we're trying to keep that up, but actually, over, I don't know, the last sort of at least 20, 30 years in the UK, if not longer, growth is no longer linked to our well-being. Whenever our economy grows, it doesn't make us happier, it doesn't make us healthier, not any longer. So what is our economy serving? What is it actually doing? So, we have to question whether or not growth is actually useful for us anymore. I think another point is that, there are some things that just don't work together, okay? So if the economic system that we have currently, if we stop growing, if we stop consuming, then the system breaks. But we've heard from almost everybody, even in the panel earlier, who were disagreeing on various different points, that we need to stop consuming. We need to decrease how much energy and how much stuff we are consuming. So that will break our economy. So we need to redesign this economy and make it actually work for us. And I wondered if you had any comments on what that might mean and how that might work and how we break this link with actually it's the economy that has a fossil fuel dependence. It's not necessarily us.
Thank you. There are a few other questions we'll pick up as well in just a couple of minutes. Do you want to come in on that?
Well, I don't want to be provocative, but it is rich people like us that live in rich countries like we live in that are the problem. You know, you won't get you know, this whole question of equity and, you know, balance across the world, and even within our country, our small country, you still have, and it was very much on the agenda of the Climate Change Commission, but I don't know that we got to the heart of it, but it's quite obvious that even within a community like ours, it is within that people like us who drive four cars and, you know, buy the 50-inch, this is not uniform across the world. So, you know, the challenge is, I could say, rather than say to you, I could say the challenge is for me to, you know, to change the way I live. Therein lies the challenge, isn't it?
Gentleman there, the green shirt.
Based on that fact, the UN said about 3 years ago that 26% of human population of the world is now using 86% of the world's natural resources. My question is there not a lot of hypocrisy going on here? Because here's the EU promoting biofuels as one alternative, and yet the greatest increase in the destruction of the Amazon rainforest is to grow soybean to be used to produce biofuels, and the largest buyer of the soybean coming out of the Amazon is the EU. But is there not a hypocrisy? So over here we're looking like we're doing something, and yet over here we're creating, I think, more problems.
Economy.
Hypocrisy on the last point, yes, obviously. the point about that we could re-engineer the economy is one well taken. The problem is, I stupidly read a lot of stuff about the collapse of civilization 3 years ago, and you got divorced from my pains, so I was miserable. There are very few examples of societies choosing a very different path to what has gotten you. Our social structure, particularly the kind of the British, what we have is a British world. You know, when we discovered, we had the Industrial Revolution, we exported the kind of Pax Britannica, so free trade and all that is our fault in a way, our legacy. And in many ways, the thing we should be most proud of, because we have lifted billions of people out of poverty. There are very few examples of societies that choose to change the fundamental incentive sets that drive them. So if you look at the Mayans, when the Mayans were faced with climate change, what they did is they took more people off the fields to build bigger temples so the gods would be happy with them so they made it rain. And no, it didn't rain. And that's what we've done, of course, with things like fiat money, with pretend money that we use, and the banking systems. And we put more and more hope in the structures we have. Now, while I say that there are very few or no examples of societies changing this way, the one chink of light I have is that the Romans didn't have universities. I would say that, wouldn't I? But earlier societies maybe didn't have the rationality of science, because that was a recent invention in the last 500 years. They didn't have that reflexiveness and self-criticism that we have currently in the West and other places, in a way which may enable us to understand the challenges quickly enough. Because other societies only ever change when they face an existential crisis, which forced them into change, and the inequalities that Howard talked about means that rich people will not face this change until it's way too late. We just push off into other people again.
Yes, question
here. Hi, Chris Blake, Queen's Energy Wales. I'm going to make two quick assumptions. One is that the planet can't cope with us burning all the fossil fuels that are still in the ground. And secondly, that the market will find a way to burn them all. So what is the political intervention which we haven't come up with yet? Let's stop that.
So that's the danger. Is it that stark?
No, it's not that stark. I mean, gas is a very, very useful fuel for other purposes. I mean, that's why BP Chemicals left Swansea and Grangetown right up to where they are now. When because all sea gas was coming on stream. You don't have to use gas to burn it. You can use it for other purposes. You can argue that it's a waste to use to burn it. You can argue that. We're wasting the oil in the way we're doing. There's a whole world. This is exactly what the farmer industry in South US is doing right now. They're saying, no, you're not going to export our gas. That's not what we want you to do. We want to keep it because we want to get the farmer industry back in the US. Gas is a lovely, lovely material. You don't have to do that.
Hydrocarbons, more generally, are intrinsic to, I mean, we're probably all sitting on some at the moment, you know, and hope no one is wearing them, because some of you, you know, maybe can't afford natural fibers, maybe we have some polyester, I don't know, or pure polyester. But it's true that if we just stop the short-sighted, you know, these are really interesting organic chemicals that we just, you know, throw up the chimney. Absolutely ludicrous. But this is the greatest value we can think of all that stored sentience to burn it. Unfortunately, the level of, I mean, prosperity that we are used to, and I come back, obviously prosperity is a subjective measure, is inherent on that surplus of energy of need and the ability to have multiple cars and multiple holidays and whatever else. And changing that conversation, as we've heard from Nick, is something very difficult. The problem is, and I'll come back to what Carl said earlier, is, you know, you wouldn't do it in a system of nation states. You wouldn't do it in a competitive geographic system where you couldn't increase the cost of something because the firms would go somewhere else. I mean, that's the problem with the Welsh Government. The Welsh Government has is it won't do anything that increases the burden, inverted commas, on the Welsh population or Welsh businesses, even if it's in the long-term interest of those populations, because they can't be seen as being uncompetitive. You had this BREEAM standard, which got watered down, because people said, you can't do that because firms won't come here. So we had a really, you know, if CAT were in Westminster, we might have a better chance. But because we've got this really, again, another holdover of the 19th century, in this case, is nation states, which think they compete with each other, even though quite often they don't, it's actually the companies that compete. We have this lowest common denominator when it comes to investing for the future, so if it's not profitable now, or change the geographic relativity in terms of economic competitiveness, you don't do it.
Any questions in terms of on political leadership of how and what type of energy we use in the future? Is that what you were going to add?
No, something else. Okay, well, fine. Let's have this question first. I just wanted to pick up the point that Calvin made about it's not countries that compete. It is countries that do compete. Most of the oil and gas is owned by countries. It's not owned by companies. And that is a big issue because we've talked about consumption, reducing consumption. The other side of that is those countries that completely depend on the export of huge quantities of oil and gas, having to leave most of that on the ground. And I just wonder what the panel's thoughts on the geopolitical implications of that, of going to Russia, of going to the Middle East, of Saudi Arabia, and say, I'm sorry, I know you're keeping your populations quiet because you're bribing them, you've got to stop.
So the premise behind the question, it's not in those states.
It's not in their
interest. It's not in their interest.
Yeah.
Hold up first, please.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. you're clearly right. I mean, so happens my wife is Polish, and there's a political agenda. The shale gas industry in Poland is strong, and it's driven by the Foreign Office. It's not driven by the Department of Business or Energy. It's driven by the Foreign Office because of Gazprom and the Russian connections and the worries about the politics of that. So I think you are right, and it will apply in the UK, If any of you were lucky enough to be George Osborne at the moment, would you, what would you think of all those resources that the UK suddenly has discovered that it might have? That's a lot of money underground, potentially.
So it doesn't come down to consumption and personal decision. It comes down to the member states.
Well, I was talking about the economy more generally in terms of the cost of the population. Not like that. You are certainly correct that a lot of governments, I won't say regimes because we've got one in Britain, a lot of governments are utterly dependent on cheap domestic energy and the resources coming from export. The only chink of light, I guess, is there's no chink of light in Russia. The Saudis know that on current trends they won't be exporting by 2030 anyway. If they continue to use their domestic resources the way they're going, they probably won't have much of an export industry by 2030 anyway. And I suspect they're probably clever enough to understand that and start to mediate a way. And you do see some move towards reducing fossil fuel subsidies domestically, probably too little and too late. The underlying kind of issue there about the West going in and telling them that they shouldn't do this. You are completely correct, but that's not going to happen.
Any other questions? Yes. Just wait for the microphone to come down, please.
shale gas in the UK, just how accessible is it? I looked at the presentation and I think it was something like 800 to 1,000 wells a year to be drilled for 10 years and we still would keep up to the pace of the decline of North Sea gas. How accessible, given if those numbers were anywhere near correct, how accessible is the shale gas?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, at the moment, the number of boreholes that have actually been drilled in the UK for shale gas exploration, and they're just fire holes, really. Clearly the one that went wrong in with the drilling in Blackpool, I think you can count on the fingers of one hand. In the US at the moment, it's 35,000 boreholes that have been drilled. So that gives you, set it in the right context, where you have to go through the exploration phase before you can come to the exploitation phase. And UK hasn't gone through that phase yet. We are where we are. These people are putting money into it. The big companies are not stupid. Or maybe they are, but working on the assumption that they're putting time and effort into it. I think there's an expectation that the Boland up in the Northwest will deliver big time. And some of the Balkan area, if it could be made to work. Because, there are oil, I don't know if you know, but there's an oil farm in Dorset that is producing oil onshore in the UK.
It's been fracked for 30 years.
Quietly sitting there, not causing any aggro to anybody. Nobody knows it's there. It's called Witch Farm. In that area where the Balkan events took place, the oil seeps out of the ground in some places. So, but those are just the plain realities. I think it's going to be very difficult in the UK, personally, because of the crowded island. It's not like the US. And I think the public acceptance issues are going to be huge.
And we've seen that in South Wales as well, where the detailed research work still hasn't happened, in terms of around the old South Wales coalfield. That's all we have time for now. Can I just thank Professor Owen Thomas and also Professor Calvin Jones. Thank you very much.